Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, Dr. Alyssa Watson, and my guest today is Dr. Heather White, a small animal internal medicine specialist and the founder and president of KW Veterinary Consulting in Kansas City, Missouri. Dr. White authored an article for the July 2022 edition of Clinicians Brief entitled Chronic Enteropathy in Cats. So today, we're going to be diving a little deeper into these common yet often frustrating conditions. Good morning, Dr. White. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, well, we're so excited to have you. Before we talk a little bit about your article, could you introduce yourself to the audience, tell us about your background, maybe a little bit about your consulting business?
Oh, sure. So I'm a board-certified small animal internal medicine specialist, and I was in practice immediately after my residency, which was somewhat not where I expected to be, and someone who kind of thought maybe I would stick in academia. And I got into practice and kind of experienced the profession for the first time. And it was very different from what I had been trained for. And I started to kind of adopt this style of internal medicine, which was really, based on how can I do as much quality medicine and what can I get done diagnostically, really within a budget, right? So kind of leaving the teaching hospital and moving over into real world practice. So after being in practice for about 8 years myself and doing consulting online and clinical case consulting, after a while, I decided that I really wanted to kind of pursue this passion of really bridging the gaps between academia and practice and also with industry as well. And, how we kind of bring these different aspects of the animal health profession together in a way that's beneficial for all of us.
That's wonderful. And I think, as a general practitioner, I really do appreciate that because we do have a lot of financial constraints that we're dealing with on the daily. And oftentimes that kind of ivory tower, academia, what people are recommending is not always feasible, every day in the trenches. So, and to tell you the truth, enteropathies in cats are just a primary example. And so I'm glad that we're going to have this conversation today.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, I think they are the prime example. And quite honestly, it might be my own experience with my own cat and, our journey through his IBD and, presumably lymphoma and et cetera, and et cetera. And what I opted to do at the time and what I truly can honestly say, as I counsel people through what my choices were and why and et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So as we said, we're talking about chronic enteropathies, and this seems like a really basic question, but I think it's still important. So what do you define as chronic in these cases?
Yeah, I mean, the kind of accepted definition of chronic is 3 to 4 weeks duration. It's still some variability there, but I think it is important to kind of understand that cutoff. I see it pop up sometimes, when I occasionally do insurance case reviews, right? Where the actual distinction between is this a chronic GI tract disease that we're treating versus an acute one becomes very relevant to the case down the line.
Sure. And what about the differential list? Does that differ significantly as well between what we're thinking of as these chronic enteropathies, at least a month in duration, or the more acute, cat that comes in that's only been sick for 24, 48 hours?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's cats are making a whole different world, right? So the length of time that any individual cat might experience clinical signs before they're presented to the vet is somewhat variable. And so the differential list being relatively similar between the two, I think it's really more the approach to therapy after that first go around is where the distinction kind of comes to this is still happening. I'm reaching for a treatment again. I think in hindsight, a lot of times, if you look back, we'll see a recurrence of an episode, maybe, a year prior, or maybe just a mention of a clinical sign sometimes in these cats' history. So the chronicity is never apparent in any individual one visit. It takes a more global perspective of looking back through the record.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you did mention with your own cat, IBD and lymphoma, these Are these what we consider really the most common causes of chronic enteropathy in cats?
Yeah, so, you know, and interestingly, even just last week, I had the privilege of, you know, being with one of our kind of top gastroenterologists, and who was speaking about, you know, maybe we shouldn't even be calling it inflammatory bowel disease, right? That really chronic enteropathy itself might be the most appropriate term for what we're dealing with here. So with inflammation being an example of one of those causes, right? So, you know, this is just an area that we continue to expand and develop our knowledge, you know, so much day by day that but in the traditional standpoint of what we're speaking about here, when we think of chronic enteropathy in cats, you know, yes, of course, we're thinking about what we call inflammatory bowel disease versus, you know, most typically this low grade or small cell lymphoma.
Okay. And then are there any clues from the history or signalment that might help us differentiate those two? Or are we going to be looking at, you know, diagnostic testing solely as a way to try to separate those conditions out?
Yeah. You know, I gave this question a fair bit of thought because you know, my initial instinct is to say, well, no. And I think that's kind of the short answer. The long answer is, you know, in a one-year-old cat with chronic vomiting as the predominant clinical sign, you know, am I going to have cancer as high on the list, right, as a dietary hypersensitivity? So I do think somewhat with advancing age, but, you know, cats between 8 and 12, 13 years old, right? It's kind of anything can happen. As we get into the really advanced age in cats where we're talking about our 17-year-old cats, then I really actually start to think of large cell lymphomas or, you know, coming into the picture. Whereas, you know, I don't worry about that quite as much in your 9-year-old cat who presents like a chronic enteropathy.
So maybe a little bit there, age is something to focus on a little bit, but other than that, not much help there.
No.
You had said that, you know, you had recently spoken to someone that thinks we should just change the name of IBD completely. Is that because we have new insights into the pathophysiology of IBD? How do we understand irritable bowel disease in cats right now?
Right. And so, you know, I think there's a lot that we're learning about the dysbiosis and a lot of that or about the microbiome and about dysbiosis. So imbalance of the microbiome and how that process causes a lot of downstream changes and effects that don't necessarily involve the immune system, you know, so things that change the barrier permeability of the intestinal tract and things that change the metabolites that are absorbed into our bloodstream and what that means, right? And so there are inflammatory cytokines involved in that process, but there's just a lot more going on. Now, having said that, cats, we have the least figured out, I would say, in regards to the microbiome and to dysbiosis, and especially when it comes to differentiating any kind of chronic GI tract disease, we're not there yet.
Well, hopefully, perhaps, yeah.
You know, it's hard to say. Yeah.
You know, and looking at those things is so important because it can help us target therapies, you know, later on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about diagnosis, if we could. So there's limitations, but there's also benefits to a lot of routine tests, you know, point of care tests that we can do right there, CBCs, fecals, chemistries. Could you go through those a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, for GI tract disease in general, you know, the reality is there's not a lot on routine basic blood work that's going to give you any indication of what's going on with the health of the GI tract. So there are some important clues, you know. Full blood work is important in animals because we don't know what we don't know. And very quickly with the results of a CBC, our diagnostic process might change entirely from, well, this might not be GI tract disease at all. All of a sudden, you know, maybe this is leukemia, right? So, but, you know, some of the things that we might look out for, you know, changes in the eosinophil count, cats certainly can have a lot of angry eosinophils when they have allergic type diseases, you know, anemia of chronic disease, erring to the side of this is a chronic problem. You know, in the chemistry, I will say that cats do not typically get a protein losing enteropathy from an IBD or even a small cell lymphoma. So kind of bear that in mind that, you know, unlike dogs where we kind of see them come in with this protein losing enteropathy, and if a cat comes in with a abdomen full of fluid, my very first thought is not GI tract lymphoma, right? Or not protein losing enteropathy. It's some other type of bad cancer.
Right, right. You mentioned just quickly the feline dysbiosis index. Can you tell our audience about that? How is this useful in differentiating causes of enteropathies in cats?
Yeah, so I mean, primarily, it's important to say that it's not useful at all for differentiating causes of chronic enteropathies in cats. But what it is useful for is documenting the presence of a chronic enteropathy, you know, but ultimately what the dysbiosis index is a ratio of a number of good bacteria and essentially, you know, bad bacteria or bacteria that when found in high numbers are associated with healthful properties. And then, you know, a couple of bacteria that when found in high numbers are associated with bad things. And so the dysbiosis index using PCR, so DNA-based methods, looks for these specific targets and kind of maps out this is what the microbiome looks like. And the index itself, you know, the higher the index, really what it's saying is the lower the microbiome diversity. And so one thing that we can generally say is that microbiome diversity is helpful in health, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's obviously a big range of normal, but, you know, a high dysbiosis index is associated with an unhealthy GI tract disease, indicates chronicity, and in some cases, the severity of that elevation, the actual makeup of pattern of some of those bacteria that have gone up and down, give us some information about potential chronicity and potentially even response to or possibly lack of response to treatment.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Is can you track it and will that help us determine whether or not our treatments are beneficial?
Yeah. So they can, and they have done a lot of that work. And you know, but there also seems to be like this point of no return for this organ system where, you know, perhaps if the dysbiosis goes too far and the diversity suffers too extremely, that there's really only one way to repair that, which is actually with a fecal microbiome transplant. So that's where a lot of research is in both cats and dogs right now. And I think that's going to factor into our IBD treatments for sure.
So another thing that we definitely all think about with GI disease is imaging. And so this is where, as a general practitioner, I always have this big crossroads right here, is whether or not I'm going to take survey rads on these cats, because I can do that easily. I can do it fairly inexpensively. Or do I just jump to an ultrasound because I always seem to end up there anyway?
Yeah, I mean, it's
and I would have to say, I don't have ultrasound available in my practice. So I have to call in an ultrasonographer or send them out, you know, to a tertiary facility.
Yeah, I mean, totally. And I think it's a little bit of a cop out, but it's a little bit case by case. And I only say that in, you know, the younger the cat, the more likely I'm going to radiograph because my foreign body, my suspicion for some sort of obstructive lesion kind of goes up a little bit. Now, of course, what's the specificity on age for having a foreign body in a cat, right? Like, you know, we know there are sometimes these cats that eat things later in life. So there's that. I think like if your physical examination clearly documents abdominal fluid, do not take radiographs. Like it's really just a waste of money. Is it always a waste of money? Yeah. You know, I'll never say always or never, but in cats, I would say, you know, the summation artifact would probably make it pretty hard to see cats with ascites. We're looking at usually carcinomatosis. There's not often a primary lesion so much as just like it's everywhere on ultrasound. So some of those things might factor into my choices. It really would be, what is the cost savings, right? So for myself in practice, at it was $350 for 3 view radiographs almost, and I would absolutely skip that and do the ultrasound. So some of those I think really should factor into your decision. If you really think this is a run-of-the-mill chronic IBD typical case, do we go for ultrasound first or do we go for a GI panel first? Well, I think that depends on where you are in your workup. And, if you're picking $240 to spend or whatever, I'd do the GI panel first, right? And then maybe get back to ultrasound later. So I think we just have to think about those things too.
And then the next big and oftentimes, not just expensive but also invasive is which ones of these patients are we going to biopsy? And that's a struggle for me too, when to step in and recommend treating empirically or saying we really need to go in and get a sample. So do you have guidelines or criteria of when intestinal biopsies are indicated?
I mean, intestinal biopsies are always indicated, right? And it's always, good medicine to offer. And, I wish I had familiarized myself with this little bit of updated literature before having this conversation. But, for instance, I believe there may have come out some competing ideas to the well, we always have to biopsy the ileum when we do these CATs, right? Because selling an upper GI tract scope is a much easier sell than an upper lower. So, if there's anyone in the listening audience who isn't familiar or hadn't really thought about it in a while, to do an upper lower GI endoscopy requires an overnight stay and a colon prep, and it increases costs substantially. It increases time. It increases biopsy sites from 2 to 4, so histopath. And I was trained that we really would be doing a disservice to not get the ileum as well if we're trying to differentiate IBD from lymphoma. Now, if the answer is that getting just duodenal biopsies actually isn't so bad, right? All of a sudden, as an outpatient procedure, you take a fasted cat who's come in for ultrasound and, you can get in and out of an upper GI tract very quickly and easily with 2 biopsy sites. So, I just think the reality is that these conversations are complicated and they depend on a lot of factors, but it is always up to the owner to decide if they want these biopsies. And, if they wanted them to be done surgically for the best chance of getting a diagnosis, that would be okay too, right? I don't believe in giving owners an overwhelming amount of options, saying, like, well, this is what we can do, these 5 things. But I do believe you say, definitive diagnosis requires an intestinal biopsy, and this is how we could do that. And these would be the next steps. And if they look at you and they say, that's not what we're going to do, okay, here's our option.
Right, exactly. There's sometimes overwhelming them with too many options can be, just as bad as not offering things, I find. So.
Yeah, totally. And I think it just literally comes down to, at the end of the day, in many cases, a price, a predictable price of, even in the cheapest that I can envision, $1,500 maybe for just an upper GI scope, and I'm just picking a number out of nowhere. If that is a number that they're not going to cross, like, conversation over, So I don't think that we need to drag on with all of our reasons why and for and this, that, and the other. We just have to kind of respect where people are and move on.
Absolutely. When you've got a challenging case in front of you, you could spend your lunch sorting through cluttered search results and a shelf full of outdated textbooks. Or you could find what you need to know in seconds, all in one place. By combining concise diagnostic and treatment information, algorithms, and pet owner resources with the Drug Information Veterinarians Trust, Plums Pro is ready to change the way you spend your day. This groundbreaking new platform is streamlined, easy to use, and continually updated to keep you delivering great care with confidence. Now you've got one less reason to eat lunch at your desk. Get acquainted with the all-new Plums Pro at plums.com. let's move on from diagnostics to treatment. You know, one of the reasons we want those biopsies is because treatment options are really different depending on the underlying cause, you know, of the enteropathy. But you do in the article specifically mention that deworming is indicated. So why is this an important empirical treatment? Why not just skip the deworming?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you think about yourself and your own animals, maybe, or, you know, if you're in our profession or in the animal health industry and you think about your cats and like how great are we at really doing routine preventative prophylactic deworming therapy? I'm not so great myself. I've never really been so regular. And even if you are, there's definitely this kind of overwhelming trend, I would say, in both dog and canine kind of chronic enteropathies where, you know, if an animal's on a combination topical product that should, you know, cover the possibility for all intestinal parasites. And, you know, I just think for me personally with the false positives, or I'm sorry, really the false negatives that we see in our kind of fecal testing, I would just be really remiss to be far, far, far down the road of diet changes and ultrasounds and all of these things. You know, I've found a chronic, poorly responsive PLE patient to have whipworms once, you know, I was crushed, right? So with true respect for, you know, parasites developing resistance, you know, I just think we need to make sure that these animals have received an oral dewormer.
Sure. Yeah. I'm right there with you. And I'm even worse because in Las Vegas, where I live and practice, we have very few external parasites, you know, so my own pet's parasite prevention is usually pretty low.
It's, oh, yeah.
If I have to suddenly board them, I'm like, oh, we need to go grab some fenbendazole.
Right. I know.
So another thing that is available, especially for empirical treatments, is diet. But there are so many. There's so many prescriptions. There's a number of over-the-counter diets. How should we as clinicians go about choosing a diet? Is this really just trial and error? Or can we, you know, are there ways that we can maximize the benefit of our diet trial?
So I love the nutritionists, and you know, if people are not aware, if they haven't heard the news, right, nutrition has been kind of adopted into the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine, as you know, we've added it in now as we've kind of huddled the specialties together. And I'm so grateful because it is such a complicated science. And so anything that I say, I just, full disclosure, I pick up these little tidbits from being fortunate enough to have conversations with really smart nutritionists. So having said that, I think my biggest take-home points recently have been that we just really, like, novel, we just have to kind of let it go. You know, novel protein, it's just time to let it go.
There's not, it's not novel anymore.
Well, no. And, but it actually, these diets really do kind of fill for cats the purpose of a really highly digestible GI tract diet. They're just not a hypoallergenic diet, most likely, or we can't guarantee that. And so, you know, where do we start with diet? I think if you're at the point where you believe you're working up IBD and you're reaching for diet in a cat, it needs to be a hydrolyzed protein diet.
Okay.
Now, having said that, if you're working up symptoms and the cat's, you know, younger, or the cat's, I mean, really, what is your baseline? Is the cat a street rat? You know, is it living off of, you know, 9 lives, you know, is it whatever's cheapest that day? And there's like a constant rotation of junky cat food, right? So, you know, if that's your baseline, you probably don't even need a prescription. That's not where I would start. You know, I'd probably just start with a higher quality food, even a maintenance food. So I'll tell you a story. My mom's cat was a stray, kind of an adult stray that got, you know, dumped at my clinic. And he's an amazing, huge orange Himalayan cat that was like clearly very well socialized, had some crazy, strange behaviors, would walk around on a leash and just like loved everybody. And And so I was like, I'm taking this cat, you know, I'm giving this cat to my mom. But ultimately, he had a microchip or some form of identification. And long story short, the owner was tracked down, and they actually officially surrendered the cat to the clinic. But as my mom was driving away back home to, you know, her home 8 hours away with this cat that I found for her, the records from the previous vet got faxed in, and the entire records for this cat's 7 years of life at this point in time were about horrible IBD, diarrhea, steroids, budesonide, like the works, euthanasia. Oh my gosh, to the point where I called my mother and had her turn around and drive back. And we did a GI panel on him, and we did an ultrasound on him, you know, and we sent him back home, and we're kind of like, well, wait. Well, long story short is, you know, he had been being fed a prescription GI diet in the hospital, because that's just what was basically our diet in an emergency specialty hospital for cats. Never had an issue with a bowel movement, has never been treated for, you know, any issues really since that dietary change. We're many years later now, and I can tell you that he has chronic cholangitis and chronic gallstones, which maybe were induced by the junky food he was, you know. So ultimately, I'm not sure IBD was ever his diagnosis. So just one of those stories to think about.
Yeah, that's a powerful anecdote.
saved by
the diet.
Yeah, Ian. Yeah, it's just by a digestible diet, you know, that was it. So,
well, before we move on from diets completely, one of the other things that I always wonder is, okay, so we try a diet and we don't see a response. Do you try another diet? Do you try a third diet? When do you say, okay, you know, we're done switching diets?
Yeah, so in cats, right, like if we take the novel protein diet kind of out of the equation, right, unless we're correcting from a junk diet to something better, and we're saying we're going to start straight with hydrolyzed protein, like there really is no next diet step. It's like, are you being compliant? Yes or no? You may consider, would you switch brands in case of some proprietary ingredient causing a reaction? You know, I doubt I would anymore. I think our focus on diet has really been shifted a lot with our understanding of the microbiome. And basically, the bottom line is IBD suspect cats need to be on a hydrolyzed protein diet. And hopefully that's all they need to be on. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of the goal as their new baseline. So switching them over to that hydrolyzed protein diet may or may not be enough, right? But that's if we can get them to that point, that's our goal.
That's the goal. And then if we need to layer on other therapies, let's talk about cobalamin. So cobalamin supplementation, it's a lot easier now than it was when I graduated 20 years ago, because there's oral products now that just weren't available before. So do you find any difference in the efficacy of those oral products compared to, you know, the traditional weekly injections that I used to be giving?
Yeah, no, I mean, so the cobalamin story is like, we know it works either way. I think ease is in the eye of the administrator. I think an oral daily pill in a cat may not be easier than the once a week injection. I think the cobalamin story, most important take home is that it needs continuous supplementation. Like, we don't cure these cats of chronic enteropathy or IBD. And so, you know, they, if they've looked and seen, like, they will become deficient again. And even myself, even in my own cat, right, this idea that, well, he's doing great, I've controlled this inflammation, his B12 should be normal. Well, what if this whole time, right, the inflammation wasn't the only thing we've been controlling? And so other mechanisms for the B12 to not be normal, I guess.
And then finally, what about antibiotics? What's your opinion about empirically treating these cats with antibiotics?
Yeah, I mean, so for chronic enteropathies, and especially in cats, right, there's just the use of antibiotics has only been shown to potentially make things worse, and certainly has not been shown to make a huge benefit. And also, I think with chronic enteropathy in cats, I want to be really cautious, because even when I was asked to write this article hear about IBD, right? Trying to discuss feline IBD in a certain number of words without spending too much time on lymphoma and not even touching on the pancreas and the liver mm-hmm. is like really, really does a disservice to the topic in general. So when we use antibiotics in cats that have chronic enteropathy-like symptoms, the question is, like, are they really demonstrating more of a chronic cholangitis in their specific case, right? So again, I really want to stress that for our typical IBD versus small cell lymphoma, antibiotics just have no purpose in there. If this cat has IBD as part of triaditis, right, and we're worried about a bacterial cholangitis mm-hmm. component, antibiotics may be part of the treatment plan, even though the real definitive treatment would be surgery to take the gallbladder out, sure. right? So it's everything is a spectrum, and there aren't really hard and fast rules except for that. We really just chronic antibiotics in cats. We're not using metronidazole and Tylosin anymore.
That was exactly the one I was thinking of, the metronidazole. Mm-hmm. So,
yep.
So when you do,
which should be good news because the cats hate it.
Yeah.
So, you know,
it's yucky.
It is good
it's
news.
Bitter.
Like, Zen. Yes. Zen. We don't need to compound it. We don't need to do it at all. Now, and we didn't talk about probiotics. That mm-hmm. is kind of one of those things where for me, if the cat will eat it willingly,
sure.
you know, there's only a couple of options. I really do stick with the labeled one, you know, mm-hmm. But if they'll eat it willingly, then that's great. Right. But I'm not one to force anything down anybody's throat if we don't know if it's going to be the big make or break. So
sure. Now, when you're doing these things, do you tend to start multiple therapies like that at once? My own story, I have polyps and like just horrible chronic sinusitis. And I finally went to an ENT guy. I got allergy tested. He came in the room and he literally handed me like six therapies. He wanted me on an antibiotic for a month and he wanted me to do like a neti pot flush and I had to do a nasal spray and I had to do this. And he wanted me on probiotics because mm-hmm. of the antibiotic. And I literally walked out of there and I did nothing. I totally, for the first time in my life, felt so for my clients where I hand them a diet and a probiotic and cobalamin and say, yeah, come back for these injections and everything. And I was so overwhelmed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry for that experience. I think I can say, and I had a maybe similar experience, but at least you didn't test positive for allergies, right? So they didn't like send you off for vaccines. So that was my like positive half glass full the day I had a similar experience, right? Because that's a whole different ball of wax, I bet, right? So yeah, cats are like, there are very few circumstances where an inflammatory bowel disease / small cell lymphoma cat is in an emergency, right? So most of the time, like, it's fully appropriate to change diet first, right? You know, you could even argue that if the cobalamin is always going to need supplemented, like, do we just start supplementing it? Like, you can argue that, right? So again, I think one thing at a time, but what I'm saying to you now is we're not talking about six things that I'm recommending to mm-hmm. start anymore, right? I've mm-hmm. recommended a diet. I've recommended cobalamin. And, you know, the next one is, are we going to do a steroid at the same time? Yes or no. And then your probiotic is going to be a secondary or an accessory in a case that you feel is severe enough that you're having that steroid discussion right away. So,
well, let's talk about that steroid discussion. That's the final thing we wanted to touch on in our conversation today. You know, I was told never start steroids without having a definitive diagnosis, get your biopsy. If you skip that, you can't come back later. It was really drilled into me and kind of scared to start these therapies that I think really help increase the quality of life of our patients. And so let's talk about some real world, you know, how do we talk to clients about this? And when do we say, okay, we're going to skip that and we're going to go for it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we touched on the biopsy discussion a little bit before, which is, you know, that like, we leave that decision up to them and like we move on from then. It's like, okay. I mean, remember, if people need more understanding, if they're like, oh, I don't know. You know, a biopsy is no guarantee, right, to a definitive diagnosis. A biopsy gives us information on potential response to therapy and potentially prognosis, some prognostic indicators, but a biopsy does not change the available treatment options for IBD or for small cell lymphoma, which are very limited in cats at the end of the day, right? So, you know, we have steroids, we have chlorambucil, you know, and then we have multi-agent chemotherapy, which is going to be reserved for kind of your large cell lymphoma. So ultimately, if my clients have been educated and they don't want to do a biopsy, I don't have any hesitation whatsoever starting steroids. It has not been my experience that people change their mind and want to go backwards. And if the situation becomes so utterly complex moving down the road, usually what's happened is not like a migration of IBD to small cell lymphoma, but like something else is going on in this mm-hmm. cat where steroids may not interfere with that biopsy, or time ultimately eventually declares itself, I think, in real everyday practical medicine, I'd say. So I'm not hesitant to start a steroid. I'm not hesitant to start chlorambucil in certain cases because of the pulse dose method of chlorambucil being for some clients, the only way this cat will get medicated, mm-hmm. you know, where they can come in every 2 weeks and we can draw the blood like we're doing any other chemotherapy protocol and administer the pill. So for instance, since I do not recommend using a long acting steroid preparation.
So no depo, no.
Right. No depo. I mean, you know, we just don't have products that last for kind of like a week or, mm-hmm. you know, something where we can feel a little bit more comfortable about what we're doing. And cats, just with the risk of congestive heart failure, the risk of diabetes yeah. like these are pretty significant. So I don't recommend a depo steroid. So in that case, if in a specific pet where the owner can't medicate, the same type of scenario where you might be reaching for a depo steroid, those are often the right situations for something like a pulse dose chlorambucil. And so it's an approved, it's a published treatment for inflammatory bowel disease in cats. So the fact that it is a chemotherapy doesn't necessarily take that off of my list, to be honest.
And then once you start those immunosuppressive medications, and I'm sure it'll probably differ a little bit based on what you pick, you know, if you're picking an oral sure. steroid or something like chlorambucil, but just generally, how often do these cats need to be coming in? What should we be monitoring? You know, are we routinely monitoring CBC and chemistry? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, so steroids, you know, it's an overall health monitoring plan. You know, we're treating to a desired clinical effect. The dysbiosis index is something that can be used to evaluate kind of like the internal health and maybe as a measurement for how things are going. Again, that's just not quite as settled out in the cat as it is in the dog, or we just don't have the same amount of studies yet. But, you know, ultimately, you're really developing a relationship with the client over the course of that period of time. It's always going to be a de-escalating recheck frequency if you're doing a good job and you're able to control the symptoms well. So, you know, if the cat starts out very sick, it might be a week, a month, 3 months, 6 months. And then if the cat's 9, it might be once a year if they're doing well. If the cat's 17, it's going to probably be more frequent, right? Mm-hmm. You know, these animals are oftentimes have other concurrent things going on besides dietary restrictions, you know. So it depends. But, you know, if it's a chlorambucil protocol, that's a very different, you know, we have a CBC monitoring structure that goes along with that chemotherapy, you know, but nonetheless, even in that protocol, it's a de-escalating kind of very similar a week, a month, mm-hmm. you know,
sure,
2 months, 3, 4, 6, a year
and
type of thing.
Communicating those things up front, you know, especially when we have these chronically managed diseases that we're not going to cure, I think is really helpful. You know, if you can give people kind of an overall view, yes, it might start out really intensive, but we're going to try to, you know, decrease this frequency over time, that sometimes that'll help with, with our client communication, as well as, you know, the level of engagement that we're seeing from our owners.
Yeah, I mean, it is a disease we manage. We don't cure. Our treatments are non-specific at this point in time. And, you know, a lot's developing about the field. But, you know, ultimately, the goal should be a remission maintained on diet in cats. And a lot of them can get there. And, you know, so the hope is that, right, you get them on the diet, you have to do like a short tapering course of something, and then we can maintain them on diet alone. And maybe that works for years. And then maybe eventually you have to add something in. We're kind of missing the piece, I think, about like the, we're just maintaining this. How do we really shut it off? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how will that correspond to the connection between IBD and does this chronic inflammation, you know, promote small cell lymphoma? And right, to like, do we have any therapeutic options that might ultimately result in less small cell lymphoma in cats, right? Sure. Like, I have no idea, right? Yeah. But that's kind of what you hope the future is not newer and different and better IBD treatments, but just less IBD in our lives. So
that would be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah, right? Who knows?
Well, that was all my questions. That was a really wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for sitting down with us and talking about it.
Oh, very fun.
Before I do let you go, though, we do have one more thing at the end of our episodes. We like to play a little would you rather game with our guests.
Oh, no. And so, okay.
Yeah. Oh, no. It's very fun. It's very informal. There's no right or wrong answers. Okay, so first question.
Great.
Would you rather practice without dexamethasone or without gabapentin?
Gabapentin.
Okay.
I can't practice without steroids, my God. What would an internist do?
Okay, would you rather examine an aggressive Chihuahua or an aggressive Great Dane?
Cat. Oh, shoot.
Oh, shoot.
I didn't let you finish. Chihuahua.
A Chihuahua. You'd go for the little. Yeah. You can kind of ball them up, I guess, in a towel. I don't know.
I'm 5 feet tall. I don't need to be wrestling
a great day.
You know, that would be like that video, like somebody captured on their security cameras of a dog walking away with the tech on their back. So,
well, I was originally a mixed animal and I thought I was going to be a horse vet, and I've always had big dogs. Yeah. So I lean towards the big dogs. Those little dogs, they just like, they're fast. They're going to get you.
Yeah. Just a huge blanket.
All right. So would you rather be able to understand what your patients are saying to you or have them understand what you're saying to them?
Oh, that's a lovely question. Probably them. Well, yeah, them.
Them.
Yeah. Yes. Be able to talk to them, I think.
So that they understand. I kind of agree. I would rather be able to be like, I'm trying to help you.
I know. The other would make my job somewhat obsolete, I think. So.
Okay. Would you rather keep teaching but have to give up clinical practice or continue practicing but no longer teach?
Oh, I'd teach and give up practice.
You love to teach. Yeah. That's wonderful. All right. Last question. Yeah. If you could have one as a patient, would you rather treat Gizmo from Gremlins or would you rather treat Falcor from The NeverEnding Story?
Oh, gosh, no. This is hilarious you asked this question. I was terrified by both of those movies growing up, especially The NeverEnding Story and Falcor.
Oh, like, wasn't it? No. Like, I liked The Luck Dragon, but the whole thing with the horse that, like, into the sinking mud.
Yes, that was tragic.
It was. Yeah. Traumatizing.
I think that was just my husband and I were talking about this. Like, we think he was a younger sibling and I was an older sibling. So, like, I think he, like, saw the videos even we were just a little bit too young. Mm-hmm. And so we feel both traumatized. And I'm like, but I think he had to, like, sit and watch them because his siblings were like, we're watching this. And I think I was able to, like, turn it off and be like, I don't. So neither. I choose zero.
Zero fake patients.
Have as a pet?
No, as a patient, if you had to treat one.
Well, the small one then, because I don't do big dogs.
And you just wrap him in a towel and not feed him after midnight.
And it sounds like a medicine patient. They're mostly gremlins anyway.
Well, thank you for playing. That was wonderful. Thanks again to today's guest for joining us, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review us. You can also listen to our podcast on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Clinicians Brief and on Instagram at clinicians.brief. Or drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief the Podcast is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ussery, sound by Randall Stupka, and hosted by me, Dr. Alyssa Watson.